Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 7th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's number one article, top of the fold, tech vet after $80 million for brownfield towers. This article is by Lee Weisbecker from Chapel Hill. Longtime Triangle-based wireless tech entrepreneur Dale Carey says he is raising $80 million to start a company that will build cell towers on brownfields and other blighted properties in large metro areas. The new firm is EcoSite Incorporated, based in Chapel Hill. Carey, former president of SpectraSite Communications and later founder of another wireless infrastructure firm, Shared Access, says this time around he'll partner with Raleigh-based Cherokee Partners, an expert in brownfield remediation. Robert Glosson, a former senior vice president of sales at CareysBandwidth.com, has been picked as president and chief operating officer. M-South, an Atlanta-based private equity firm, is the lead investor in the deal, Carey says. According to U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission documents, five investors have purchased shares in EcoSite, pumping in nearly $11 million of the $80 million target. M-South, which has a total of $710 million under management and which has invested in other telecom plays, has been given three seats on the EcoSite board. We like this opportunity, and we like the management team, says M-South partner Barry Boniface. We think this is going to be a good investment for us. Another director of the new Chapel Hill firm is Russell Casella of Credit Suisse Private Equity. Other than saying Credit Suisse is participating in the deal, Carey declined to provide a complete investor breakdown. The proceeds will be used to begin the scale-up of EcoSite, which at present has five staffers. Carey says 10 more will be added in 2013. The firm will also begin scouting potential brownfield sites across the country that will be purchased and then cleaned. There are at least a million brownfields in the U.S. and a million more blighted properties, he says. EcoSite will then build what Carey calls microcell platforms, ranging in height from 35 to 120 feet. The platform space will then be leased to wireless providers. The use of reclaimed brownfield sites for wireless development is a concept which has been winning adherence in recent years, says Gary Rosmus, a brownfield expert with the Woodbury, New York office of engineering consultancy, Gannett Fleming. The process makes economic sense on a couple of levels, he explains. First, the contaminated property can be acquired at a discount. Second, as far as the remediation is concerned, you don't have to do much to it as you would as if you were preparing the land for residential use, says Rosmus. And the end result is good, too, since you have returned a piece of property to productive use. Carey, who was president and COO of Shared Access for 4 years and president of SpectraSite for six, will be CEO of EcoSite. Other executive officers in the startup include General Counsel Richard Stern and COO Robert Glosson, both of whom served stints at SpectraSite. Growing in the 1990s, SpectraSite was a cell tower operation that experienced ups and downs before being acquired by American Tower in 2005 for $4.1 billion. Next up, Medicaid costs would rise but could be offset, by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. North Carolina would spend an additional $5 billion on Medicaid between 2013 and 2022, taking the total to $71 billion if it fully expands the program in line with health care reform guidelines. That amount, based on estimates from the Kaiser Foundation and the Urban Institute, is a lot of money, but some policy analysts say the expansion could end up saving money for everyone in the state. Under health reform, as upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, states may elect not to expand Medicaid, which is health coverage for the low-income population. The Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation and the Urban Institute, two research organizations headquartered in Washington, D.C., released a detailed analysis of how a Medicaid expansion would affect states. If fully expanded, Americans making up to 138% of the federal poverty level, $15,415 for an individual, or $26,344 for a family of three in 2012, would qualify for Medicaid. The Kaiser Urban Report estimates that North Carolina could see an additional 568,000 people enroll in Medicaid by 2022 in that scenario, which would mean the state would spend $71 billion on the program between 2013 and 2022. Without the Medicaid expansion, the group estimates spending of $66 billion during that time. The federal government still pays a majority of Medicaid bills in every state. If Medicaid is expanded in North Carolina, federal costs in the state would hit $172 billion between 2013 and 2022. Kaiser estimates, or $45 billion more than if Medicaid is not expanded. Those numbers don't tell the whole story, however. In fact, some argue that increased spending on Medicaid could end up reducing health care costs for everyone. Hospitals routinely write off millions in uncompensated care or bad debt. Because so many new Medicaid enrollees will have been previously uninsured, it could reduce the amount that hospitals write off, potentially allowing them to reduce costs for everyone else. Determining the cost of Medicaid expansion to North Carolina involves considering not only the direct cost of providing coverage, but also the savings that come from having fewer uninsured residents and an overall healthier population, says Brenna Birch, a policy analyst for the North Carolina Justice Center, who wrote a brief analyzing Medicaid expansion here. She calculates that 95% of new enrollees will have been uninsured. The benefit could be particularly pronounced in the Triangle, says Adam Linker, another policy analyst for the North Carolina Justice Center. He points out that the federal government agreed to cover 100% of the additional Medicaid costs for the first 3 years, beginning in 2014, so the state will not shoulder that burden until 2017. If the state waits to implement an expansion, it would lose out on one or more years of money from Washington. Because the Triangle is hugely a healthcare economy, the influx of federal dollars would benefit this area more than others, Linker says, pointing specifically to hospitals and pharmaceutical or medical device companies. All of those would benefit from a Medicaid expansion, he says. Physician groups also support expanding coverage. We are hopeful that the state will ultimately expand Medicaid, says Dr. Shannon Dowler, newly installed president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. We do understand the concerns about costs for such an expansion and the financial difficulties our state faces. However, we believe, over the long haul, that patients will have better access to care and improve health care outcomes through appropriate coverage. Continuing on the front page, enrollments decline, admissions down at most local law schools as demand wanes. This article is by Chris Bagley, and it's from Raleigh. Law schools have narrowed their incoming classes as they eye large numbers of unemployed young attorneys and middling demand from law firms, traditionally the most common employer of recent graduates. The Triangle's four law schools welcomed about 850 new students in the fall of 2012, below 855 in 2009 and 863 in 2010. Three of the four shrank this year, North Carolina Central University being the exception based on estimates. The incoming class at North Carolina Central University was unusually small in 2011 and somewhat larger than normal in 2012. Most admissions deans say they're keenly aware of the lingering gap between the numbers of students applying and the number of graduates who move directly into full-time jobs. Some say that's a reminder to choose applicants who can be prepared to face that reality. Other schools say they're actively trying to align their numbers with the smaller market for traditional legal jobs. For all that, the trend in the Triangle is modest. First year enrollment is 44,840 nationally, down 9% from 2011 and down 15% from 2010, according to the American Bar Association. That parallels sluggish hiring among law firms, which account for roughly half of recent law graduates' jobs. In-house legal departments, nonprofit groups, and government agencies such as regulators and district attorneys account for the remainder. Many business-oriented firms in the Triangle shrank in 2009 and 2010, and some began to rebuild only late in 2011. Even firms that are actively hiring, such as Raleigh's Wyrick Robbins and the large regional firm Womble Carlyle, have said they're doing so in a focused manner, and only when they're sure they'll have enough work for the new associates. For Wyrick, a firm of about 70 attorneys, the dynamic means inquiries from the sorts of third-year students who used to apply to national firms, managing partner Jimmy Yates says. The quality of resumes we see from third years, as well as laterals from other firms, is just phenomenal, Yates says. It's almost unprecedented. Part-time and contract attorneys have also become somewhat common in the last few years. Solo practitioner Mitel Patel of Triangle Business Law in Raleigh says he worries that law schools are still churning out more graduates than the traditional market can absorb. 2 years into practice, Patel is preparing to hire his first associate, but he says he faced a surprising flood of job seekers from the get-go. Even established lawyers, Patel adds, I think that says something. The modestly smaller numbers of incoming students won't do enough to correct the imbalance between graduates and the number of traditional legal jobs, Patel says. Many schools are putting a new emphasis on a law degree as preparation for a wider range of jobs, including CEO positions. Two of the Triangle's largest publicly traded companies, for example, have been led by attorneys. War Nye at the aggregates producer Martin Marietta Materials, and Bill Johnson at the former Progress Energy. Both represented those companies with outside law firms before heading in-house and eventually to the corner office. Progress's merger partner, Duke Energy, is also led by an attorney, Jim Rogers. Incoming classes at both Campbell University and UNC Chapel Hill, whose graduates often go to work for Triangle area law firms, shrank slightly this year from prior years. Relatively large numbers of NCCU graduates end up working for government agencies. Duke, one of the nation's top-tier law schools, sends most of its graduates out of state, including many to New York and Washington, D.C. William Hoy, the school's associate dean for admissions and student affairs, says its smaller incoming classes in 2011 and 2012 reflect an effort to rebalance after larger-than-expected numbers of applicants in 2009 and 10 chose Duke over other schools where they were accepted. Moving inside the front page, new Lenovo leader deep in supply chain. This article is by Lauren K. Onisores and is from Morrisville. Lenovo's operations in Morrisville represent ground zero in the Chinese company's avowed bid to become the number one computer maker in America, and Jerry Smith is the site's new captain. With Smith, the company has chosen an operations guy steeped in the intricacies of supply chain strategies. That's a good move, says IDC analyst David Dowd. When you want to run a tight ship like Lenovo, obviously that's a very, very critical to have a good handle on what's happening in the supply chain and to make sure you manage the cost in a good way, says Dowd. Lenovo recently nudged past HP to narrowly take the lead in PC sales globally, according to Gartner Research, but is still number four in the United States. And that's the challenge for Smith going into 2013. Make Lenovo number one in America. To that end, Smith, a native of Oregon and father of four who joined Lenovo in 2006, plans to continue the marketing effort the company put into play this year, efforts that have already greatly increased the brand's profile, he says. To aid his mission, Smith, like many executives, yearns for certainty in the U.S. economy. Questions about the fiscal cliff. The impact of the overall American economy. It's important that the leadership of our country closes that issue so we can focus on growing. I know Lenovo will outgrow the market, and I'm excited for the U.S. to get back on track. He says not to expect any major changes on the local front, but there is a big difference between Smith and his predecessor, David Schmuck, who left after a short tenure. While Smith has developed an expertise on the supply side, Schmuck was a marketing executive. That supply chain is going to be increasingly important going forward, says Dowd, due to customers' increasing demands for lower price points. You need someone like Jerry Smith to be able to do that, he says. Smith will stay on as the head of global supply for Lenovo until April 1st and will remain a member of Lenovo's executive committee. Gartner analyst Mikhail Kitagawa is upbeat on Smith's promotion, saying he is a good candidate to continue to expand Lenovo's manufacturing facilities in the U.S. He's going to manage supply chain improvements, she predicts. I think it is a very important role for him to be there because he has some great experience from Dell. Both Smith and Schmuck previously worked at Dell, and Schmuck returned to the Round Rock, Texas company when he left Lenovo. Smith says his management style isn't much different from that of Schmuck, and that his operation skills are directly transferable to his new role. I'm a very direct, committed, results-oriented type of person, Smith says. I'm as direct, as transparent as you can be from an executive perspective. Smith says he'll continue to expand the company base and footprint in North Carolina. It's a footprint that is already expanding with an announced expansion in Whitsitt, near Greensboro, that has already added 115 jobs, he says. As that is successful, we'll continue to be able to expand that operation, he predicts. Smith, who has the choice of staying where he was already stationed, in Singapore, and moving to the Triangle, says it was an easy decision to relocate. I love the feel of the area, he says. I will leverage some of my operational expertise and look for areas of opportunity for efficiency. And now, legislators will aim scrutiny at EcoDevo groups, by Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Nonprofit groups and government agencies that recruit large employers to North Carolina expect their work to be reshaped by newly dominant Republican legislatures, and they're gearing up to influence the coming bills. North Carolina's system of economic development is complex, with state, regional, and local organizations pitching the strengths of the state and locales within it to potential employers and matching those companies with tax credits and other incentives. The system is also unique in its use of 7 regional partnerships that are run by the private sector but funded in part by state government grants. That is one of several state government functions that Republicans say they may try to streamline in an effort to save money and encourage commerce. While Republicans aren't targeting economic development agencies as heavily as regulatory boards and commissions, key legislatures declined to rule out any changes. The party expanded its majorities in both houses of the General Assembly and won the governorship, marking the first time since Reconstruction that it has controlled all 3. All options are on the table, says Harry Brown, a Jacksonville Republican who chairs the Senate Commerce Committee. One of those options is to align the regional offices of various state agencies, Brown says. The Commerce Department has 7 regions, while other agencies have 5, 6, 7 or more, and many overlap each other. Legislators worry sometimes that the multi-layered system of economic development itself isn't cohesive, says Don Donadio, a tax and economic development attorney with Womble Carlyle, who serves on a competitiveness task force for the North Carolina Economic Developers Association. We can expect some changes, but we don't know what those changes are going to be, Donadio says. Economic developer Charles Hayes says he sees collaboration and a lack of hierarchy rather than a lack of cohesion in regional partnerships among their members. Hayes, who is president of the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, says he meets regularly with economic developers from RTP and the 13 counties because it's beneficial for all 15 of them. They don't work for me, Hayes says. They come because they want to come. Deputy Commerce Secretary Dale Carroll, who oversees economic development, couldn't be reached for comment. Tony Alameda, a former Duke Energy economic development manager who is now on the transition team of Governor-elect Pat McCrory, also couldn't be reached for comment. Economic developers also expect significant changes in the state's tax code, a major focus for McCrory and his campaign. McCrory and other leading Republicans have called for lower tax rates and fewer incentives such as tax credits and deductions, and some have called for outright elimination of income taxes. "We want to get out of the business of picking winners and losers," says Sanford Republican Mike Stone, vice chairman of the House Commerce and Job Development Committee. Economic developers say such incentives have been an important tool for economic developers, but add that a simplified tax structure could be an equally important tool. Donadio says he believes the state should keep targeted tax credits even as it cuts taxes. Rates on corporate income tax could conceivably fall to around 5%, he says. At the same time, the General Assembly may raise sales taxes on goods and introduce taxes on a wide range of services, he says. Restructuring your tax code is very difficult, and it will take an enormous effort. North Carolina's current corporate income tax rate currently stands at 6.9%. Continuing on inside the front cover, on the rise. As consumer confidence surges and buyers look for lower fees, more turning to credit unions. This article is by Lee Weisbecker and is from Raleigh. Membership numbers continue to surge at credit unions across the nation, in North Carolina and in the Triangle, new data show. Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union, North Carolina's largest such institution and the second largest in the U.S. with total assets of $25.3 billion, boasted membership by 5.2% to 1.8 million in the 12 months ending September 30th. That was nearly double the national growth rate of 2.7% for the same time frame. Meanwhile, a Raleigh-based local government federal credit union, membership rolls expanded by 7.4%, once again outpacing the national rate and the statewide growth rate of 3.2%. The third quarter 2012 numbers were compiled by the National Credit Union Administration, the industry's federal regulator. But interpreting what they mean is left to others. The industry's Washington, D.C.-based trade group, Credit Union National Association, or CUNA, dubs the recent growth trend explosive. The nationwide growth rate of 2.7% for the year ending September 30th is three times higher than that in 2011. CUNA's senior economist Steve Rick attributes the growth to several factors, including improving consumer confidence and an aversion to higher bank fees. He adds a third factor, namely a rising tide of new car loans. Nationally, the volume of new car lending rose by 7% for the year ending September 30th, after shrinking for the past 4 years. "I think in some cases you can say people were joining credit unions to get these loans," he says. "It's a sign of things are getting better." Rick's hunch is reflected in at least one Triangle credit union. New car loans at local government, federal, jumped by 80% to total loans of $45 million in the year ending September 30th, according to filings. Credit union spokeswoman Erica Hinton says local government lowered its interest rate on new car loans to 1.99% in June and plans to keep it there through January. But whether there is a correlation to the membership gains, well, we'd need to pull the data to check on that, Hinton adds. Meanwhile, at three other local groups, State Employees, Coastal Federal, and Durham-based Latino Community, the volume of new car loans, while remaining at healthy levels, has not shown any recent spikes. Coastal Federal, meanwhile, experienced a 5% membership decline to 180,768 in the year ending September 30th, due to the organization's decision to consolidate its operations in the Triangle, closing offices in Charlotte. Membership rolls at Latino grew by 1.4% to 52,552 in the period. And looking at the various explanations for membership growth, Jeff Harden, a spokesman for the North Carolina Credit Union League, points to a shift in consumer mindset that evidenced itself around 2011's Bank Transfer Day. As people reconsider their banking relationships, credit unions are now getting attention as an alternative, he says. This seems to be the message on the street these days. Next up, North Carolina and three other states join to unify jobless pay system. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. An estimated three-year, $110 million effort to place the payment of unemployment insurance benefits in four southeastern states, including North Carolina, on a unified computer system will go out for initial bids this month. The U.S. Department of Labor, looking to save costs by replacing legacy state payment systems, earmarked $13 million for the multi-state effort back in 2009. The other states are South Carolina, Georgia, and Tennessee. Officials from the four states have been working since then to come up with a technical plan to get the job done. The resulting document with a proposed IT architecture recently got a go-ahead from the Tennessee Procurement Commission, and that state will take the lead in the procurement process in what promises to be a massive system. The federal government will pick up the implementation costs. Requests for proposals have been drafted. And they are on target to go out in early December, says Jeff Henschel, spokesman for the Tennessee Department of Labor, and Workforce Development, although we are still working on an exact date. The initial bidders are expected to be large to mid-size IT integration firms on the order of Chicago-based CSG Government Solutions, which lent a hand in doing a feasibility study on the four-state project. Eric Sweden, Enterprise Architecture Specialist with the Lexington, Kentucky-based National Association of State Chief Information Officers, says the bidding process, one of the first in the multi-state category, will be closely watched. It's one of the early strategic projects, and it should attract a large number of industry players, he says. Depending on how the contract is written, the bid winner may look to hire IT subcontractors in the four states. But at this point, says North Carolina Division of Employment Security, DES, spokesman Larry Parker, those matters are still up in the air. Until a bid is confirmed through the RFP, knowing how many jobs would be created is difficult to determine at this time, he says. What can be said is that North Carolina, with what is considered the oldest UI benefits paying system in operation anywhere, is looking for an update. We look forward to having a new processing system in place, Parker says. In 2009, during the height of the recession, North Carolina's current legacy system paid out $2.7 billion in jobless benefits to 675,300 recipients across the state. Since 2010, it has paid out an additional $5 billion. The U.S. Department of Labor's idea to join groups of states in consortia to modernize their IT systems is aimed at shaving costs. Henschel says the four states in the current project operate under similar UI laws, allowing their systems to be pulled together. I don't think it would have worked out otherwise, he says. Absent the multi-state effort, each state would have tapped the federal government individually to replace legacy systems. And that's just something we can no longer afford, says Sweden. I don't know if you've looked, but we are becoming a poor country. This week's next article is entitled, Carry Company Sniffing Out Bug, Yes, Bug Technology, by Lauren K. Onisorge. From Carry. Smart Hound. Think of it as a beverage container, but instead of being full of coffee or tea, it's full of bugs. Oh, and one day it may be able to detect breast cancer. It's a little strange, Cary-based Bennett Aerospace co-founder and president Doug Bennett admits, but it's really neat. Bennett Aerospace began in 2008 and acquired South Georgia-based Smart Hound Technologies last May. It is an insect-powered technology that's currently aimed at detecting hard-to-find bedbugs. Its founders hope it will one day be able to smell cancer. The insects, Microplitus Crocipes, dubbed sensor bugs, are in the wasp family. While they don't carry a sting, they do carry a sense of smell. The sensor bugs are trained to associate a tempting treat, sugar water, with a particular smell, specifically the smell of bed bugs, the welt-causing pest known to hitch a ride in a traveler's suitcase. The process of training the bugs would elicit jealousy from an HR director. It takes about 2 minutes. The bugs are then placed in a cartridge, a small plastic container with tiny air holes. The cartridge slides into the beverage container-like device, a prototype. Bennett hopes the real device will be about the size of a soda can. A fan wafts air into the cartridge. Should the sensor bugs sniff bed bugs, they start to swarm, an activity that is caught by a camera inside the lid of the device. The research initially was funded by the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, in its search for a way to detect bombs and licensed to benefit aerospace by the University of Georgia and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, both of which developed the science surrounding the insect's extraordinary sense of smell. We know that certain insects' antennae respond to odors at a molecular level that our state-of-the-art equipment cannot even detect, Bennett says, adding that the applications for detection are endless. Instead of trying to reinvent with computers and silicon chips, why not make use of the organisms themselves that have perfected this? While a lot of testing has been done over decades, the bugs still have not been field-tested. That's part of the reason Bennett Aerospace is turning to crowdfunding, utilizing the website Indiegogo, where interested people can invest directly in the product. People investing a certain amount will get a prototype and will help in field testing. Bennett says the money also will go toward overall research regarding sensor bugs, including medical applications such as training the bugs to smell breast cancer. The amount of interest generated in the crowdfunding will be used as an indicator of the amount of consumer desire for bed bug detection devices. Prior to the decision to look at marketing to consumers, the company approached hotels. They didn't want to pay for it, frankly, he says. With 49 days left to reach a $100,000 crowdfunding goal, the company had raised only about 2% of that from its Indiegogo effort. Should crowdfunding fail, Bennett will look for more grants, he says. One federal grant is already pending, he says, though he won't be specific. Joe Lewis, who helped discover the science while at the USDA, has been looking for a $500,000 investment prior to being approached by Bennett. Lewis, whose work with the sensor bugs netted him a Wolf Prize, first published the bug sensor research in 1990. Little progress has been made in commercialization over the past 30 years. Lewis says that's because of the discoveries are completely new. Mitch Taylor, general manager of Raleigh-based Capital Pest Services, says bed bugs are a growing triangle problem. We deal with them almost daily, he says, adding that almost anyone can get an infestation, and infestations are hard to detect because of a bed bug's uncanny ability to hide. Visual inspections start at $50 per unit, and canine inspections can run upwards of $100 an hour, he says. And now, Old Alcatel site has a buyer, but plans are still under wraps. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Raleigh. Nearly 10 years after a group of Chapel Hill investors bought the hulking Alcatel telecommunications plant in Raleigh, interest in redeveloping the site is beginning to perk up again. The 23-acre plot, which is between the Costco and Trader Joe's stores on Wake Forest Road, has never officially been listed or marketed for sale, says co-owner Laura Van Zandt. But development groups from around the country have still managed to find the owners. Van Zandt confirms that the property is again under contract to a real estate investor group considering a mixed-use development, but she would not disclose the identity of the potential buyer nor the terms of the pending deal. We've had a lot of developers look at it over the years, and it's certainly too early to say that, yes, a sale is going to happen, she says. Raleigh real estate broker David Urban also is part owner in the property, but he says the ownership group is in no hurry to sell. We had the property under contract right when the market crashed, he says, but after all that happened, we mothballed it. More than 312,000 square feet of building space on the site was torn down in July. And the Enterprise Rental Car Company has been leasing part of the property for parking its rental fleet. Until that happened, the property has been used as a park and ride lot for the North Carolina State Fair. Van Zandt and her partners at ITB Holdings, LLC, paid $4.2 million to Alcatel for the property in 2003. But the property's land value for tax purposes is more than twice that. According to Wake County tax records, the land is worth at least $8.9 million. Before Costco built its wholesale warehouse store at the corner of Wake Forest and Six Forks Roads in 2006, sources say Costco had first made an offer to buy the Alcatel site. That offer was turned down. Big box retailers such as Home Depot have shown interest in the site in the past, but most planners agree that the 23-acre site would be best suited for a mixture of uses, including office, retail, and residential space. "We'd like it to be a combination of uses," says Mark Pitney with the Latt Purser and Associates real estate firm, which leases and manages the Holly Park Retail Center next to the Alcatel site, where Trader Joe's has its store. "Additional retail would not hurt there," Pitney says, "but office and residential would all make sense." The property had for decades been a research and development facility for the ITT Telecom Company, later Alcatel, until the 2001 recession hit the technology markets particularly hard and forced the company to downsize and sell the building. Now called Alcatel-Lucent, the company still has about 200 workers at an office building it leases in North Raleigh, but its presence in the Triangle has diminished since selling the Wake Forest Road building. Next up, propelled by a $4 million grant, professor hones in on faster computers. By Lauren K. Onisorge from Raleigh. NC State University professor Paul Franson is on a mission to create more efficient computers. That's a seemingly simple goal that gets complex in a big way when it's considered that his challenge is to create a multiprocessor system with a computing-to-power ratio of 75 gigaflops per watt. Think 1,000 arithmetic operations per second, he explains. To put that into perspective, the most efficient processors on the market currently have a computing-to-power ratio of 16 gigaflops per watt. Fortunately, he has help from a Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency $4 million contract to support his research. Franchin's team is utilizing 3DIC technology, three-dimensional integrated cores, with a goal creating a highly efficient multiprocessor that can fit inside a matchbox. The watchword in that is efficient. In 3D, there's an added vertical element, which increases productivity and efficiency, and that's the whole point of the project. The amount of computation you can employ in many circumstances is dictated by how well you can deliver, he says, particularly in devices that can be deployed with troops in the field, a particular interest of DARPA. Challenges in developing such devices include how well power can be delivered and how well devices can be cooled, since energy delivery often means heat, and even a field-worthy generator can only do so much. They only have a limited amount of power output, and the amount of computation you can do with that limited amount of power output is not enough, Franson says. That's where Franson and researchers like him come in, utilizing three-dimensional technologies to reduce how much power is needed to move data. Instead, devices can spend that power in other areas, such as graphics computation. Improved efficiency wouldn't just have military applications. Franson is thinking bigger. You could do 30% better graphics on a cell phone or tablet, which means you could play better games, he says. The computer graphics in a cell phone or tablet are quite limited compared to a desktop. The reason, to make a complicated answer extremely simple, is the heat. Smaller devices simply can't handle the heat energy needed to deliver super complex applications and move the data. This isn't the first time Franson has taken up the challenge. He netted a $1.5 million grant from Santa Clara, California-based computing giant Intel in 2011 and is still working on that research. He has also been involved in projects with Qualcomm and other entities involving mobile phones. While Intel is not an official partner in the latest endeavor, the Intel project dealt specifically with chip structure. The company is interested in the work, Franson says. Franson is working with a group at Pacific Northwest National Labs on his project, as well as three other faculty members, one staff member, and five doctoral students at NCSU. The efficiency battle is a long-standing one among computer companies, meaning many opportunities for future commercialization. Intel CEO Paul Otellini referenced efficiency in the company's last earnings call, sharing details of the company's next-generation core processor that is targeted for the 10-watt envelope. Rory Reed, CEO of Sunnyvale, California-based Advanced Micro Devices, an Intel competitor, also referenced efficiency improvements in AMD's last call, saying that his company is looking to leverage its full suite to deliver differentiated solutions with industry-leading performance per watt. But the real value in Franson's research may be found in the future of mobile devices, an industry that should see 117.1 million units shipped this year alone, according to Framingham, Massachusetts-based research firm IDC. It's early, he cautions, adding that the goal of the current phase of the project is simply to come up with an efficient design. The rest can come later. This week's Spotlight article is on education, and its title is W, as in Withdrew, Kicking Up a Ruckus, by Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. A seemingly benign policy change for transcripts at UNC System schools has students protesting and two chancellors siding with the students. The topic involved what registrars record on the transcripts of students who withdraw from a course in the University of North Carolina system. At present, university-wide regulations do not stipulate that the transcript should reflect that a student withdrew. The UNC Board of Governors, the body that oversees the 17-campus system, could implement a policy that understands withdrawal as one area of concern and empowers the president to enact a regulation that transcripts should limit the number of times a student may withdraw from a class and include a W on the transcript. Various UNC universities already have their own policies on withdrawing from courses after the first 2 weeks of classes. Take UNC Asheville, for example. Students there may withdraw from a course only through the end of the sixth week of class, will receive a W when doing so, and those dropped hours count towards calculations for tuition surcharge and academic standing. By contrast, students at NC State University may drop courses during the first 8 weeks of regular terms and not receive a penalty. The policy is about setting reasonable parameters within which campuses can define their own policies, says Sandy Gavitt, former chair of the UNC Faculty Assembly, who helped develop the new policy and presented it to the BOG committee. The parameters account for sound academic policy, federal regulations, and prudent resource management. Students have been outspoken about the proposed system policy change because they say it would make them look bad, especially if applying to graduate school, possibly due to extenuating circumstances that were out of their control. In a letter to members of the UNC System Board of Governors, BOG, Andy Walsh, student body president of NC State, and Will Lemonstall, student body president at UNC Chapel Hill, wrote, quote, having a withdrawal appear on one's transcript because of a dropped course would create a stigma where currently there is none. During these difficult economic times, we have enough challenges to find employment and graduate school admission. Our university should not add more to that burden, end quote. Chancellors Holden Thorpe of UNCCH and Randy Woodson of NCSU took the students' side. I just don't think it's right to ask a student to take the W, Thorpe said at a BOG committee meeting where the policy was discussed. Woodson agreed and argued that the decision should be made at the campus level. Technically, the committee discussed a broader policy report titled Fostering Student Success that was presented by a work group of representatives from various campuses. It passed unanimously and will be taken up by the full Board of Governors in the new year, but the specific regulations of adding a W to transcripts was left at the discretion of the system president, Tom Ross. This week's Washington Watch is by Kent Hoover. Small businesses fear the fiscal cliff. Small business owners are more pessimistic now than they've been at any time over the past 2 years, according to a new survey by Wells Fargo and Gallup. Uncertainty over whether elected officials will manage to avoid the fiscal cliff is making small business owners less likely to hire more workers and invest in growth, according to the quarterly survey. The findings were based on telephone interviews with 607 small business owners conducted between November 12th and the 16th. The Wells Fargo Gallup Small Business Index fell 28 points to minus 11, the lowest level since the third quarter of 2010. That's an eye-opening drop in optimism, says Mark Bernstein, head of small business for Wells Fargo. And Chamber, expand energy production. The expanding domestic energy production should be part of any deal to reduce federal deficits, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Drilling for more oil and natural gas in the U.S. not only would create jobs, boost domestic manufacturing, and enhance national security, it could also bring billions of dollars in additional revenue to the federal government, money that could be used for deficit reduction. That's according to Tom Donahue, the Chamber's president and CEO, who hopes that Congress can reach a deal this month to avoid the fiscal cliff and set the stage for a sweeping deficit reduction agreement next year. Spending cuts, entitlement reforms, and comprehensive tax reforms should be part of that agreement, Donahue said, but energy should play a major role as well. Finally, problems bank decline. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's list of problem banks has fallen below 700 for the first time in 3 years. That's according to FDIC's third quarter report on the banks it insures, which found that overall bank profits of $37.6 billion were up 6.6% from the same quarter a year ago. This was another quarter of gradual but steady recovery for FDIC-insured institutions, said FDIC Chairman Martin Grunberg. Mr. Kent Hoover is Chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. This week's Small Business Profile is An Artist at His Core, Leager Crafts, Beers, and Cabinets at Boylan Heights. This article is by Lauren K. Onisores. From Raleigh. Venture beneath the Boylan Bridge Brew Pub on Boylan Avenue in Raleigh, and it's another world. A 12,000 square foot cabinet shop, and it's all Andrew Leager's world. Cabinet maker, brewmaster, and restaurateur, Leager has been doing it all since moving his shop and opening the brew pub in 2006. As for the pub, it's known for its 3,000 square foot outdoor deck. A sports bar, it is not. No televisions, Leager says, and no ruckus. As a community bar, Boylan Bridge prides itself in maintaining a low-key atmosphere, a feature appreciated by the residents of the nearby Boylan Heights neighborhood. As for the beer brewing business, it could get a lot bigger, Leager says, noting that he's working on a business plan that could take Boylan's 10 signature drafts outside the bar and into stores. To understand Leager's multifaceted business, one has to understand Leager. Not Leager the restaurateur, but Leager the artist. I've always made stuff, he says. I've just always been fascinated by pieces of wood and how wood behaves under the tool. Originally from Raleigh, his love of woodcraft took him to sawmills and construction sites in New Hampshire and Boston before trekking to Ashe County in the North Carolina mountains to build cabins. Economic woes in 1983 brought him back to Raleigh. It was by being away for 10 years that I was able to discover this was my home, he says. Leager decided to try his hand at being an architect and earned an architecture degree from NC State University. But as he worked with design teams in the Triangle, he realized something was missing. I would go to the construction sites and wanted to take out the tools out of the guy's hands and say, look, this is how you do it. He laughs. Of course, I was on the design team, and I couldn't do that. Through it all, Leager was fascinated with joinery, using hand tools to replicate the craft of an old-timey cabinet maker. It's just a matter of buying more and more tools, and suddenly you find yourself in business, he says. And that's when he found his calling, or at least one aspect of it. In 1997, he launched Special Projects, a woodworking shop on Martin Street. The business expanded, and in 2005, he found the Boylan location, perfect due to the downtown locale and the promise of mass transit. They claimed they would have commuter rail up and running in 2008, he says. The downstairs space in the Boylan building he deemed good for his cabinet shop. Then, he recalls, I had to confront the use of this top floor here. I thought, why not ask the space what it wants to be? Leager, who's been brewing beer in his home for 10 years, decided the space wanted to be a cafe or a bar. He settled on a brewery. He developed a business plan for two businesses, a brew pub and a carpentry shop, sharing resources and billing processes, as well as some staff. Leager got 13 investors on board, mostly from the Boylan Heights neighborhood. He intended to raise $450,000, and while he didn't quite make it the goal, but by investing his own resources, he started the dual business. Among the investors is Raleigh attorney Dave Permar, who bought a limited partnership interest for $30,000. I think you can only go into an investment like this with money you don't really need, Permar says, adding that years later he's still happy about his investment. We may eventually get a very substantial return. The brew pub did about $5 million in sales last year, capitalizing on the deck Leager envisioned and built. That deck used to be six parking spaces. It's a unique view, and nobody else has it, he says. I thought, why not put 150 butts in the seats instead of six cars parked there? It was the best thing we've ever done. Next up, to branch out into selling beer outside of the brew pub, he'll need to raise around $300,000, he says. The good news? He already has a brewery that currently produces about 450 barrels of beer a year. This week's guest column is by Mr. Michael Jacobs. Mr. Jacobs is the CEO of Jacobs Capital and a professor at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School. He has served as Director of Corporate Finance and Corporate Governance Policy at the U.S. Treasury Department and is author of Short-Term America. Why Business Owners Need Boards. The old adage, it's lonely at the top, applies nowhere better than running a private company, where CEOs make daily decisions about disciplines in which they have no background. Having worked with more than 200 private company owners over the past 25 years, it's my observation that the most underutilized resource for private companies is a real board of directors. Owners who want to maximize the potential of a company and fully enjoy the experience of running a business need to surround themselves with a seasoned, diverse complement of business minds that meet on a regular basis. Most business owners have complete autonomy. In fact, the primary reason many start their own company is that they don't want anyone looking over their shoulder. However, not only is running a business too complex for any single individual, it is no fun to make decisions in a vacuum over an extended time period. Business owners succeed because they are really good at something. It might be science, medicine, manufacturing, or sales. But that something is rarely business itself. The Achilles heel of most business owners is that they don't know what they don't know. It is not an admission of failure to acknowledge that you need help making key business decisions. In the 1980s, the board of Coca-Cola, one of America's most successful companies, was comprised mostly of marketing experts, with a sprinkling of lawyers and doctors who were buddies of the CEO. Coke's stock had been dormant for years. Roberto Grezzetta emerged from an unlikely background, head of the R&D department, to take the helm at Coke. The chemist questioned everything about the business despite its great success, and he reconstituted Coke's board with experts who knew what he didn't know. Over the next decade, Coke stock grew tenfold, dwarfing the S&P 500, largely the result of implementing new financial strategies his prior board had never considered. Today, Emory University's Business School is named after Mr. Goizetto because he knew what he didn't know and built a board to supplement his skill set. What should your board look like? The key to constructing a successful board is to assemble a diverse set of business skills that are complementary, not redundant. You need at least one person who has significant knowledge of corporate governance. Unless there are people in the room who know what a board is supposed to do and how boards function most effectively, you will have the blind leading the blind. You also need someone with knowledge of the specific industry and its competitive landscape. You need an expert in finance. Most private company CFOs are really controllers. You should have a board member that knows all aspects of the capital markets and has worked on transactions. Even if you don't immediately need to raise equity, borrow money, make an acquisition, or sell your business, someday you will. The backgrounds of the other board members depend on your business and your personal skill set. Recruit directors whose competencies are in the areas where yours are the weakest. Your board should meet at least 4 times a year. Otherwise, directors can't get to know the company and manage its team, limiting their ability to offer insightful advice. While it may be counterintuitive, the best boards have even numbers of members. A board decision should never be determined by a single vote. If a solid majority of the board is not convinced a path is the right one, you shouldn't go down it. Your directors should receive some compensation. The amount informed depends on the size of your business, its financial resources, and its stage of development. If you have the right directors, their sage advice is probably worth many times what you pay them. Consult your board between board meetings. Directors are a resource 365 days a year. And studies show that the private companies with true boards outperform those without. What is not commonly known, though, is that business owners who have true boards of directors enjoy their jobs more. And it is not so lonely at the top. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds. Reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.